Hey everyone, it's Vodka O'Clock, and I'm Amber Love of AmberUnmasked.com. This episode is sponsored by Audible. For a free trial of audiobooks, go to audibletrial.com/AmberUnmasked. And if you check the show notes, I've even included a link directly to an interesting Macbeth commentary audiobook. So today I am talking with Rika Jang from Red Stylo Media, and we are here to talk about Shakespeare Shaken. Rika, welcome to the show.
Thank you. You know, you started recording and I started shaking.
Oh, no.
A little stage fright. So.
Stage fright. Well, we are talking about being shaken. So.
Indeed.
Yeah. Indeed we are. I know. It's interesting. It's exciting sometimes when you're not used to hearing yourself talk. So hopefully this will be painless because you're used to being at the booths all the time.
I can do the patter. You know, when I'm talking to people and I'm in a big room and there's a whole bunch of stuff going on, I can shout and scream for people's attention. But when it's just me and everybody's looking at me, I start shaking a little.
Okay. Quick, take a shot. No.
Oh, you know, I should. I had a little too much coffee this morning. So. Thank you for having me.
Oh, of course. So Shakespeare Shaken, is this the second sort of twisted parody type anthology that you've done?
Yes. This is a sister title to the Poe Twisted anthology that we did towards the end of last year. And I was a literary major and these are my heroes and just absolute passion projects. And it's a lot of fun to sort of see people's take and work with people who also love Poe or also love Shakespeare. And that's just been a really great experience. So success the first time, you want to do it again and keep going.
That's great. So both books are graphic novels, is that right?
They're anthology collections of original comics inspired by Shakespeare. So the original one was inspired by Poe. The idea was to take a favorite character setting from a beloved work, twist them, and tell something new. A lot of companies do anthologies, anthology collections of adaptations and retellings of these classic works, and rather than kind of join their ranks, we wanted to do something new, because the whole idea is to showcase new art, showcase new talent, but then also bring to life a new generation of work.
Right, so something that people might be more familiar with are the fairy tale lines, like fables, or on TV there's Once Upon a Time and Grimm, so it's sort of the same premise where we've taken something that's historical and been a part of most people's lives, at least in as far as our education goes, and just like you said, rework it and try to make something else creative from it while honoring it.
Absolutely, and it is an it's to honor. These are passion projects. These are tributes, and it's a lot of fun to see people when they recognize something beloved in these new works. It also brings light to these fantastic new artists because it sort of brings to life this new innovation and where we're coming from, where we're going, and it's a lot of fun to sort of see people play and really enjoy how we're twisting things and making things new. So that's a lot of fun too.
So explain to potential readers what the stories are like, because I know reading actual Shakespeare was very difficult for me, and I probably could not do it outside of a classroom setting with somebody coaching me through what all of it means. So these particular stories, since they're new takes on it, what are they going to be like?
Well, it's difficult to encapsulate that because as an editor, I really encouraged all of the artists and writers to go crazy. We've got some very experimental pieces, which I'm very proud of, whereas you have sort of a recognizable setting, but then bringing a twist to your expectations of what the interpretation is going to be. And when it comes to Shakespeare, I mean, some people absolutely love the pieces. And then some people sort of remember this, throwing their head into their hands with frustration when their English teachers made them kind of come
right
through this. So if we can make it fun and sort of show people and demonstrate that how much this is lent to our culture and pop references, and we've got one wonderful story called Surviving Shakespeare that sort of plays on Oberon in the woods looking at reality TV, because a reality television crew has popped into their woods, and he's sort of looking at this sideways, sort of thing, this is for this fake reality television, this is not exciting enough to please the eyes of a king, so, and he kind of pops in and has him take over reality TV, which, with a Shakespearean twist, so okay. It turns into this kind of battle royale ridiculousness, and then the lawyers get involved from the network, this fun kind of, sort of poking fun at our present-day culture, but then also bringing in this wonderful Shakespearean twist to things. And,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
because so, you know, there are things that you, when you think everything's already been done in comics, that somebody does come up with something so bizarre that an original that you haven't seen yet.
Right. Well, in that, there is that, and there's also the oldies but goodies.
Right.
And so a fun combination of those things, I think there's going to be something for everybody in this collection. And it's a lot larger in scope than even the Poe Twisted anthology that we did last year, because so many people were inspired by being able to come in and given permission to kind of futz around with canon. And that's a lot of fun.
So how many pages are expected in the book? Because I know there's a digital version and a printed version, so let's get into the differences there.
Okay, yeah. Well, there are going to be a total of 17 stories, but we do have individual works from some very talented artists who popped in. So the total folio is 30 different pieces, 17 stories, and we're looking at about 220 pages in the printed version. So people look quite a lot of bang for your buck.
That's quite substantial, absolutely.
Yes, and the Poe Twisted anthology last year was only 95 pages, so that gives you an idea of how much more is being poured into this new book. So I'm really excited. It's going to be divided by comedies and tragedies as well, sort of giving people sort of a thematic flow. It's funny because we're giving a tragic twist to a lot of Shakespeare's comedies and then sort of a comedic twist to a lot of Shakespeare's tragedies. So it's going to be fun to see people's reactions to where we place. For instance, Taming of the Shrew is a futuristic story about these cyborgian assassins.
Okay.
And it's just fun. So we've got a lot of fun stuff in store. And they just an incredibly talented group of people. And you are one of them, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I'm very excited.
Yeah.
So what's in the digital version?
The digital versions, each of the stories will be released online individually. So hopefully the each one is sort of an entrance point into the greater anthology. They're $1.99 each on the website and a bunch of different places online. And then we'll be bundling the stories into the comedies and tragedies later. So the great thing about digital in general is that it sort of makes the playground bigger. The print version, you're still confined to, we've got the stories, we've got the dividers, we've got the presentation, but we can't put in all of those extras, otherwise this thing would be an encyclopedia. But with the digital versions, what fans are going to get is the writer can put in, you know, a couple of pages or even the whole script of the 8-page story, or the artist can have added a bunch of fun, their original sketches, and then their horrible editor called them and say, no, you've got to change this, you've got to change this, but then you think they could put more stuff in, and that was the great thing about the artistic license. Everything that you've done is going to be put into the digital version, and so it's a bonus for readers to go to the digital version and download stuff and see the sketchbooks and the extras, and connect with the artists on an individual scale, and then the greater anthology is going to be this beautifully printed trade paperback where everybody is together, and I'm excited about that part too.
Yeah, I love to see the hard copy done. I don't know why it feels more real to me.
Oh yeah,
it's just one of those things. And plus, you can't at least I don't know how you can. How you can share stories through an iPad. I have no idea how that's possible, but I know I can leave the paperback like on my coffee table and and it'll be okay, you know.
Well, I was a purist. You know, I have, in some respects, I'm very traditionalist, but I was a purist for a long time. I just want books, and I just want this. What I've found is the new media is incredibly exciting. And then from a publisher's point of view, being able to, for instance, include two versions of a story. An example is we have a story that is kind of a Macbeth in space kind of narrative by these two fantastic the writer and artist team. What was really funny is that as the editorial process went along, the writer and I, the writer came back with, you know, one ending, and I sort of pointed out to him, okay, this is a little bit more adaptation. Let's go something new. Like, the assignment is, like, to twist it and make something new. So he came up with two different versions.
Okay.
That sort of bring it away from that adaptation and sort of told this fantastic, and you couldn't decide. We couldn't decide between these two fantastic endings that he sort of took this great twist and making it really cool. So we talked to the artist, and the artist added in the extra pages, and so we'll be able to show both versions in the digital edition. Yeah. And that's just fun.
It is exciting. I mean, digital is flexible, you know, and as you said, it's, you know, there are things that you can do with it that you can't.
Yeah. And relatively inexpensive. So from a market standpoint, it's really cool to be able to give fans more. Like, fans always want more. And so if we can show the scope and variety of everything, that's just a really, really cool part. And,
How does that affect you as a publisher when you go to different Comic Cons, when, you know, you have digital material, when you're there at your booth and you've got, you know, maybe stickers and pins and shirts and things, what, you know, how do you promote the actual books that, you know, that they might not write in front of you?
We're seeing an emergence in the market. I've got a really good, one of the artists on this book, we were in the middle of editing the story, and then his daughter kind of was tugging on his arm and saying she couldn't find anything to read. And he looked at her like, what do you mean? You've got, like, all of these books. And what she meant was she couldn't find a digital book that she wanted to read. And she didn't want to pick up any of her. And I was horrified when I heard this, but then I was also giggling because this is a new part of, like, new generation, new part of the market. Your question was, you know, at a convention, it's becoming more of a market convention that you need to have a digital presence and the physical book. Because, you know, everybody, a lot of traditionalists like myself, you want the book, but then your legitimate project if you've got this other stuff. And then you're seeing this in television, you're seeing this in movies, and part of it is offering fans more of an interactive experience with the project, but then also it's an opportunity to be even more artistic with a project, because you're not limited by, you know, the amount of money that you can put into a print run and stuff like that. So I'm finding at conventions that it's expected that fans can go online and get extras, but then it's also a bonus because you can stay in front of them. You only have a little bit of time to get people's attention at a convention in hopes that, you know, even the press gets in front of you and you make enough of an impression that when they go home and they're writing up their stories about the con, that you're staying in mind. But then if you can give them something interactive at the table, and then they go home and then they're writing up their pieces and you're giving them even more online when they're following up with you, that's a way to sort of stay in front of everybody and deliver more and give people more value for the project and be as creative as you want to be. And so I have to look at it as a positive. That's a lot of pressure to keep going, but
certainly
it's a lot of place. It's a lot of space to play too.
Right. I mean, and that's the thing. I do. Do you do book shows as opposed to just Comic Con?
We're starting to expand. I think with the original anthology, Edgar Allan Poe gave so much, lent so much. I mean, it's obviously naturally gothic. But we got, you know, a lot of comic fans. And then we also got a lot of literary fans. And there's such a industry built into the Poe name, like restaurants and museums and all this other stuff. It's an opportunity to get in front of more people. Shakespeare is that way as well. And it gives us an in to be a little bit more literary. So the flip side of this is the expectation, I think, for a lot of this project has been that we are like a primer for new people to get into Poe. And some of these stories are not all ages titles. The collection is mature content. It's not, you don't want your kids necessarily hearing some of these bad words or seeing some of these pictures with, you know, blown apart heads or zombie entrails and all this other fun stuff. So it's been funny, a little bit of a headache, but also kind of funny to sort of tell people, okay, yeah, you don't want to give this to your middle school class. Maybe some of your advanced high schoolers.
They're already drawing stuff anyway. They're doodling on their own notebooks and drawing that content.
But that's that question. And so I even had to, one of the artists, you know, who comes to shows and sells with me, like he was trying to, it's very tempting to create this all ages book and then be a primer and then try to sell teachers on the idea that, oh yeah, well you can't get your freshman English class to be interested in Shakespeare. Why don't you give them this? And then I'm going to get angry phone calls from school board members and parents saying, yeah, what did you do to my child? Yeah. But, you know, everybody has to make that decision, of course. And but we're not a primer. What we're doing is, you know, people who already love Shakespeare jumping in and twisting and doing something new, or people who already love Poe and bringing it alive and bringing more stuff to folks to think about it. And if we've done our job, then you want to go back to the original Shakespeare.
Absolutely.
You want to go back to the original Poe and sort of see where it came from. And that to me is a success. But we're not going to shortcut for anybody. That's not what this is. So.
Okay. So how can people order Shake and Shakespeare?
We are going to be available at Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com. You can also order from the website, redstylomedia.com, in our online store. We're quite a few venues, as a matter of fact. Graphically, Amusedom, drivethroughcomics.com. We're trying to get it into, you know, as an independent publisher, we're trying to get into as many online venues as possible. So, but yeah, and if you've got any questions about where to find us, then redstylomedia.com is the best place to go, and you've got it open for you.
Okay, and we're hoping that there will be some local, you know, independent comic shops that will at least take, you know, have a copy or two in their store to make it available as well.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, you know, it's a different sort of scale than Barnes & Noble, obviously. But
that's where the artists come in, too. It's got a wonderful group of people who, of course, you know, when you're contributing to anthology, you're bringing to light new talent and people who all in one place that you might not have been able to find on your own. So everybody involved in the project has been really, really great about talking to their local shop and getting in front of them and doing signings and coming to a convention near you and all that other stuff. And so,
right, which definitely makes it easier because we are so spread out.
Yes.
You know,
that's a fun part too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, but it's great when, you know, you might get different creators at different shows, even, you know, get the chance to meet as many as you can.
Yeah, and I always thought that was cool, too. You know, even before I started, you know, Red Stylo, I was really excited to meet creators. And really, it's a special thing to be able to be in front of people and talk to them about the work and figure out their process and get to know your industry. So that's a lot of fun.
Why did you want to become a publisher?
Why? Yikes. A couple of things. I was really, really lucky to get an internship at Marvel. And I got to work in the X office. And I had always loved comics and, you know, wanted to be part of this industry. But being able to start there was fantastic.
Absolutely.
See the pinnacle. Like, just see, go to the mountain, visit the mountain. It's cool stuff. And so, and you want to be a part of it any way you can. And that's what's different about, to me, what's different about comics versus regular literary market. If you want to get taken seriously in comics, you have to have your own title. You have to have your own work out there. and pushing that there are success stories where people have just been able to, you know, send in a script or send in art and then get picked up, and God bless those people. It's fantastic.
It's very rare.
But for the rest of us, we you want to, you're taking the hits and taking the rejections by like sending in all this work, but at the same time, life's short and you want to get these stories out there. So what started with, my partner, Jasmine Ruiz, the artist that I started with our first series, Azteca. We had both been interns and we wanted to stay out there and wanted to keep going. And so we put together that series. And then as you're doing indie work, you're meeting more talented artists and getting together with people and talking business and talking shop. Why not? So they all started as passion projects, and it's turned into a company. And
that's
fantastic. But that's how we started, just wanting to get a story out there and excited to do that.
And then you managed to grow where, you know, this went from self-publishing to now you are a publisher. You are taking other people's work and getting it seen. So you've had to, you know, be an editor and be a publisher. So what is it like to make those delineations?
I think it didn't occur to me, as a fan, there are certain things I always wanted to, you want to see, or things that you don't quite understand, like why publishers make certain decisions. Often it comes down to money.
Of course it does.
And that seems like such an intuitive thing, like it shouldn't really be a realization, but once you are in the weeds, and once you're really getting down into the dirty about what is possible, that stuff makes a lot more sense. And so I've become, it's changed how I see content, it's changed how I see campaigns, and some stuff that as a fan, to me, seems like, well, duh. As a publisher, you're like, I see where you're coming from, but, and that becomes, that becomes the issue. So, everybody's like, you know,
right.
You learn more about it, and of course these things become clear once you're finally into it. But that to me is still the most profound realization, you know, once you're...
I imagine it's not easy. Basically, if you feel that one of your contributors, that you're breaking their heart by saying, no, this isn't working, it's still something that, as you said, is for the good of the book. It's for the good of the project.
Right. I'll tell you, I mean, it's good that you mentioned it. With the anthology, for instance, I had I was very, very lucky to get the attention of some incredibly talented people who showed interest in the book. And I was excited to have them on because wouldn't it be great to have this name on the book? Wouldn't it be great to have that name on the book? And then I would get a script that was phenomenal, but that was still an adaptation of Shakespeare,
rather than something new.
Mm-hmm. And so I actually ended up stepping on a few toes on this project, sort of saying to them, "Yeah, this is awesome. Like Shakespeare in space. Oh, really cool."
Right.
and if I had accepted all the really great scripts that I had gotten, we would have had an entire volume of just Shakespeare in space, and nobody's allowed to steal that. We might still do it, but it couldn't happen. And sort of getting a little bit of pushback from a very talented person and telling them, like, this is great. I'm weeping because I can't take this. But the book is this. The book is not another, you know, classic retelling of, like, a lot of people do Shakespeare collections. A lot of people do.
Right, including Marvel.
Right, including. Exactly. And they're money. I mean, people do them for a reason. Like, one, they can be moneymakers. And so, but this project was supposed to be, at its core, something different. And so constantly reminding people, like, yeah, this is fantastic writing, or this is, you know, but it can't be. That's not what we're trying to do. And so, yeah, but that was like a little mini part of the greater issue. You're like, yeah, you've got this book, you've got this project, you've got limited resources and a limited market, and how are you going to maximize all of that?
So. And I think that brings up an interesting point in that, just because it's an anthology does not mean that there are creators you've never heard of. Some people, you know, might have that impression that this is like a school project sort of a thing, and it's not at all. I mean, we've got people that are very experienced that have come in to this project, and then you do have, you know, so it's a broad range of experience. On the
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, there's a funny story. When I was thinking about this new book, I had written the introduction to Poe Twisted. Mm-hmm. Because this was going to be a bigger book, I was interested in having somebody else come in to write the introduction, you know, to give it some more gravitas. So I went to Dirk Manning and asked him if he would do an introduction, because he, you know, he's got a column, he's got his own books out. He's like, you know, what I want to be as an independent creator coming in and doing these books, and the level of recognition he was getting. So I only asked him to do the introduction. And then he said, hey, do you mind if I
write a story?
And I was like, I tried to play it cool on the phone. I'm like, sure, whatever. And then I put the phone down. I'm like, yes! And so having him part of it was really, really cool. And actually, it was the same thing with you. I was thinking, you know, I'll ask her if she might want to, yeah, maybe like do something with the project or something. And then you're like, I would love to do a story. I'm like, yes! Having these wonderful people come on has been so cool, so cool.
And luckily, unless sometimes this just happens, but in the indie comics world, it's a small group of people, and it seems like everybody knows everybody else. So when you start seeing the names, you know, as the list was coming out, it's like, oh, I know that person. Oh, I know that person. Oh, I know that person.
So it's going to be one big party. This book is one big party.
So. Yeah, so it's just, you know, it's people that have always wanted to work together, and now there was finally the opportunity. And
I think that comes from the love of Shakespeare, too. I mean, like,
absolutely.
You know, whether you groaned when you had to read it in middle school or whatever, just the absolute love of the literature at the heart of this, even though we're doing something new and cool, like that is love, that is a tribute. And so I think people want to be part of it because it's a fun and cool exercise. And then the product is amazing.
So putting together an anthology it can be one of the most challenging things of project management. If anybody's in project management, then you just know how derailments can happen. So what was the biggest obstacle that you've had in your anthology experiences?
Well,
I mean, there could be any. I mean, it's broad. I mean, it could be, you know, there's, you know, maybe people aren't deadline sensitive and as you'd like, or maybe it was, you know, tough rejection conversations. I mean,
thankfully, I didn't have to do very many of those. The biggest challenge was I'll tell you what, I went into this kind of cocky, thinking that I had learned my lesson with some of the Poe stuff last year. I'm like, I'm going to give myself a great big cushion, and I'm not going to tell any of these artists. So like, it's due.
Don't tell the artist about flows.
2 months of cushion. I beat all of you. And I ended up needing every single minute of that cushion. Some of it for even just, you know, the editorial side of it, but most of it, I had an artist who the week his story was due decided that, I'm done. Can't do it.
Oh no.
And that and then you don't want to punish the writer because, you know, the writer had their script finished and turned into me in February. So 4 months later, you know, a month and a half before the story is due, and then they're not going to be in the anthology for that reason. So it's like, I was very, very lucky and ended up finding a wonderful artist who worked very, very quickly and just busted his ass to get the pages to me. And they're fantastic. And I think the story ended up being, I think the story ended up home, exactly where I needed to be, as a matter of fact, because it's wonderful. So that was really, really cool. And so that was a big challenge. That was a huge challenge. But I think
when it comes to deadlines and wrangling a project of about, you know, 20 people or 30 people, whatever it is, and you're on a schedule, as you said, you're on a writing schedule too. So there's the writing schedule, then there's the editing, you know, revision schedule, then artists. And I mean, were the artists on basically on their own, or did they have to meet other deadlines as well? Like, did they have to have a thumbnail submission and then a pencil submission, or was it just get all of it done?
Right. I think what we tried to do was, you want to have a gentle touch as an editor, mm-hmm. but also a firm hand. And so what I found is that, you know, an artist that might sort of balk at giving us layouts or might balk at showing us the pencils first ended up thanking us in the end when there might be changes or there might be, you know, and so...
Because you don't want to see a finished page, especially not colored, and then come back and say, okay, but this isn't working now.
Right, and as an editor, you don't want to do that, too, because you know, it's not like these artists are printers. It's not like, mm-hmm. they're not just like spitting the stuff out of a desk jet. So yeah. a lot of blood and sweat goes into this stuff, and then, so as much as people, but I found that, you know, they wouldn't be working on this project if they couldn't work, you know, with
right.
me or work with, you know, that wouldn't happen. So I can say with a lot of confidence that everybody who ended up in this project has been wonderful to work with. From an editorial kind of point of view, I've found that an anthology is a lot easier even than just a series to put together, simply because there's always someone you can pick on. Like if someone's kind of working over here, you push them over this way, and then if once they're fine, there's always someone else like to go and start. So if I woke up in the morning, I'm like, you know, I want to see how my book's doing, and then like, you're fine. Ha. You
okay.
pick on them, and so if any of the people who are working on this project are listening to this, I love all of you, and I only did it because I love you. I promise.
So, well, we had Dirk on a couple weeks ago, and Dirk Manning, because we have two Dirks on the book. So Dirk Manning was on the show a couple weeks ago, and he's very excited. And I okay. know that he talked about how when he did the story in iambic pentameter, I just went, "You're insane." I already knew you were insane, but I'm just confirming that you're clearly insane.
Well, the best part was that when he announced very grandly on Facebook, "I'm going to do my story in iambic
yep.
pentameter," and my answer was, "Well, how cute! You think you're the first person who's going to be doing that in this collection." Another artist, and I, you know, admittedly, I was trying to stir a little something on Facebook, because I got the other writer who had also
yes.
done a story, and the two of them back and forth a little on Facebook. So, and I'm just sitting there cackling in the background. But yeah, he's not the only one. You know, he did his entire story and my iambic pentameter. So, you know, kudos, props where they are due, of course. But the other guy had some a lot of fun stuff in his as well, in iambic pentameter, which is fantastic.
Oh, that's just it's giving me this sort of Neil Gaiman vibe to it, that that because there will be a difference in artistic styles, and there are very different stories to be told, and yet at the same time they could be in the same universe. Like, you know,
mm-hmm.
You know, somebody could be writing something about one particular character too. Like, you know, I get the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern sort, you know,
yeah.
characters. It's like, but somebody else could have easily said, "Well, I'm going to do something else that's, you know, from Hamlet, but it's about this." You know.
Yeah. No, I'm so psyched that you said that, because as you're, you know, selecting artists, or as you're looking at different scripts, you are thinking about how everything's going to mix together, and then sometimes you're just like, throw it in, let's see if it works, and then it does, and your name one time. So, no, that's really, really cool you said that, and I hope so. And people can see some of the pages in progress on our website and some of the covers. Each story has its own individual cover, and like, we'll be revealing more of those as time goes on with the digital rollout, and that's the fun part, so.
Okay, and when it comes to the printed version, did you do all of the, you know, graphics assembly of everything, and, you know, do the layouts and table of contents and all of that, or was that somebody, was that yet a different artist?
I actually, the book design, I did the book design, for this book, because it was a lot larger, I was very, very lucky to bring on two assistant editors for this, Erica Schultz and Andre Fatino, and Erica has been instrumental in helping me with the actual cover to the anthology and a lot of the other design, and then Andre was really great in like, you know, bugging. Sometimes you do need someone who's just going to be like, oh, Enrique, shut up. You just need Enrique, shut up. And I think that's his role. I think he's the Enrique, shut up assistant editor. I should probably, like, credit him as that in the book. but he was the other guy who just kind of kept me grounded with some of the stuff. And so I've had some help from those two wonderful people. And,
Do you get help from your family, too? Because I know a lot of creative people come from creative families. I don't, but I was just wondering if you did.
My dad's an engineer, so no.
Nope.
I have a mother who loves me very, very much, and I get a lot of mommy support from her.
Okay.
But no.
Okay. You're not pushing things off on your husband and saying, you know, look, I just can't read this right now.
He does get the crazy. He does get to deal with me staying up late into the night and working on stuff. So maybe you could have him on your show and, like, the real the dark side of Shakespeare Shaken. But, no. It's good to have. I don't want to lie. I do have a wonderful family. And so nobody ever does it alone.
But you're not a writer-artist team. You're not a book designer and publisher team.
No, my parents are just very, very loving and supportive, and my husband's in the Army. So sometimes he looks at me sideways, and he's just like, you're doing what? And that can be very grounding, too, though. So you do need that counterbalance, too. So,
what do you think you've improved the most on since you started making comics?
Oh, what have I improved on? That's a good question. Understanding what the artist has to go through. I am a writer and interested in obviously doing my own projects, but the anthology certainly was a wonderful way to... I don't have my own story in this project at all. It's all this wonderful, talented group of people that said, hey, we'll jump in. And that was fantastic. And so removing myself, I don't want to say remove the creative side, because obviously I am an editor and involved in each of the projects, but removing my ego and removing my creative imperative in the project and seeing what everybody else is going through, that is huge. That is really, has opened my eyes, and I hope that's made me better. I can't confirm it's made me better, but I really hope it has, because I have great respect for other writers, whereas I might have been more competitive before. It's difficult to write an 8-page story. Like, anybody can maybe ramble for 120, 150 pages, but to be concise, precise, and be, all of that stuff, that is cool. And then these wonderful artists who like blood and sweat, and most of these people have day jobs, and most of these people are only doing it because they love it. And that much work and that much talent and professionalism into a passion project is fantastic. So I'm very, very blessed to be able to do that. And like violins and roses and tears in the background, I love all of these people that I've gotten to work with, including you. I love you so much, Amber.
Oh, I love you right back.
It's such a cool thing. So I hope that makes me a better writer. I know it's made me a better editor to have this profound respect for all these people. And I think that's going to be evident in the book itself. So
I think it's one of those cool things, though, as a writer, to let go. And because for anybody who doesn't know how this anthology was done, we did not know what the art was going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
So we turned in scripts, and it was going to be a surprise. And obviously there's just faith in knowing that, the product will be good, because we've seen the other work come out of Red Silo. So at the same time, it was, your reassurance saying, I'm matching people, I'm matching their styles together, I'm matching what they want, and they're, and that was something where it was like, okay, well, I have no control, so there's no point in being stressed about not having the control.
No, you handled it with much grace. your story was a very particular challenge, too, because you brought to life this wonderful And I don't, you know, I actually looked and was trying to find anybody who brought together like sort of a Rome and steampunk. Nobody had done it. And so how do you find an artist who never done it? Nobody's ever done it, and there's nothing to work from. And then, you know, Jasmine had branched into, Jasmine Ruiz was the artist on your story and had branched into, was doing more steampunk, and she could bring, and she happened to love the Rome television show on HBO. So she's like, oh, this will be so cool. And so to watch her go crazy on this, I knew she's fantastic. And what was really cool is posting the page in progress and then seeing the internet like explode with excitement when they saw the first couple of pages.
Yeah.
Oh, it was amazing. So that was
Absolutely. Because, you know, my co-writer, Kristen, is the type of woman who sits around her house in a corset because she loves them. So, you know, she...
Don't we all?
I'm in scrubs and a t-shirt right now. I'm, like, all about comfort. And, you know, it's just so funny how my love of fashion is not in me wearing fashion. My love of fashion is looking at it and designing it and yet not being in it. And so it was, you know, it was just one of those things where, that, you know, and then not having contact with Jasmine's, you know, but what we did was, you know, we collected images that we thought were really, really cool, and we just said, here, this is our vibe, this is our tone, our texture, our, you know, our new take on steampunk, because it blended everything from, you know, cyberpunk and, you know, gothic fashion, so.
Yeah, that is, I mean, you know, you're talking about control in a project, I mean, The nature of comics is collaborative. I mean, there are some very talented individuals out there who do everything, but
they're very rare. It's very rare to pull that off.
The rest of us, though, you know, have
most
to.
Most people are a team, part of a project
right.
team.
And
yeah.
it's like a little fling too. I mean, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, and but I can't stress again, you know, how lucky I know I am to have found some wonderful people who did just kind of throw in their lot together and are entrusting their work to me. And that is, you know, that is a great weight and responsibility as well. But I'm excited, and I think I'm really hoping everybody, I know everybody's going to be excited too. So.
How old were you when you read your first Shakespeare?
My first Shakespeare? Oh, yikes.
I think I was a freshman in high school.
I saw Shakespeare before I read it.
Okay.
And so, and I'm ashamed to admit this now, but I had the same, you know, as a little kid, sort of getting dragged to the park to see a bunch of people running around on a stage. You don't really know what's happening yet. So I'd seen it before I read it. And I had a really wonderful English teacher. I had a few wonderful English teachers, as a matter of fact, who took the time to cut through the moans and groans and the "oh, I don't want to be here" side of the class, and who made us stick to reading. And to this day, I still remember the I had to memorize 16 lines and deliver them to the class.
Oh my goodness!
And to this day, I remember it, and it's because someone forced me to kind of do that. So probably middle school, high school, but I'm so thankful they did, because I obviously love Shakespeare. So
I think it's important to be exposed to, you know, these things that are considered great works of art. I mean, I've never read most of the classics because I was in a real just, you know, basic college prep level for English, and because I was a very slow reader. I probably, like, I could have tested into the AP classes, but I was just like, oh, forget that. I'm way too slow. So so it was just one of those things where I liked my, you know, things like Shakespeare and whatever book of the year we were doing. I liked having a teacher to walk me through the process. So especially with some of the older, more complicated stuff. Like, I mean, we read things like the Cain Mutiny in one class, and I just, it was exhausting. I'm like, I would never pick this book up and just read this. It's
right.
Like, you know, 600 pages about the Navy.
And you know what? I don't even like people who do. Like, the people who can just pick up 600 pages and, like, they're sitting there entranced. I don't even like those people. So
yeah.
I'm certainly not one of them. But, you know, sometimes you do need to be exposed to stuff that, you know, you wouldn't otherwise pick up. As a literature major, though, you know, Shakespeare was. Definitely.
Obviously, it's going to be a...
And teaching is very, very important from that aspect. If you have someone who has the ability to unlock some of this for you, unlock how fashioned and how purposeful every line and every word in Shakespeare is, and sort of introduce you to the world, and then if you take to it, you're there for life. You really are.
How do you feel about the movies and the claims that he actually was not the writer?
Honestly, it doesn't matter to me. It's an intriguing mystery.
It is.
Like, the death of, like, how Poe really died is an intriguing mystery. It doesn't change the words for me. Now, how would I feel as a writer if centuries later all of my wonderful works, as they're remembered, are attributed to someone else? I would probably be really pissed. But,
right.
Sorry, Willie.
Right. It's just, you know, it's one of those things where, like, the Tolkien heirs, like, there are heirs that are currently alive, so, you know, so they've got that, but what if they weren't there? Or what if, you know, when their lineage dies out and somebody just suddenly says, oh, you know, this guy did not write these books?
Right. Well, a couple generations from now, people could be saying anything. And, like, you're starting to see people who... It was funny, I was reading this article on Twitter about the age gap is so readily apparent now with, you know, kids on Twitter asking, well, who's Dick Clark? Or who's...
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Or who's Billy Crystal? And if you've never seen Princess Bride, and then you...
It'd be just hilarious.
Right. And so you start to see this as time goes on. Like, some stuff that you figure, well, yeah, everybody knows. Very, very slowly is getting to. And just like that story about, you know, the little girl who doesn't want to read non-digital books. Like, where did that come from? Like, you never...
Yeah, I know. I can't even comprehend that.
But she's little. She's young. So we can forgive her.
I do love the convenience of the e-reader. It is fabulously convenient, but it doesn't... And my mom actually prefers it. That's what's so funny. My mom is such a great reader. And we were really hesitant to get it because her eyes going bad and glaucoma kicking in and things like that. She loves this Kindle Fire. She just thinks that it is so much easier on her eyes that now when she picks up a regular book, she can only read for 15 minutes and she has to put a book down. So she can read for, you know, an hour or two on the e-reader because of the backlighting.
Whereas, interesting. I can't.
Yeah, so she's the exact opposite of me. I'm just like... I open up an e-reader, and especially if it's a comic book, I cannot embrace it on the digital yet. I mean, I have too much of a hard time reading it and trying to follow word balloons in order, and I just feel like I'm holding the thing up to my face trying to read the lettering. I'm, you know, maybe that's the difference between whether something's a comic or prose, but...
I'm a little bit of a curmudgeon when it comes to... reading books. I love bargain books, and so if I don't, you know, I like to read them, and I never throw a book away, but like, I'll sell them or swap them or whatever. I won't read books. I like my e-reader, but I have the old e-ink reader. I won't read a book on a backlit screen, just because it actually hurts my eyes to do that. When it comes to comics, I have really liked the flow panel to panel. When I'm reading a PDF online, I will sort of zoom up on the screen so that I'm reading it panel to panel. So, you know, certain reader systems now online, if it creates that flow for me, I actually really like that.
That's what I've heard. I've heard that some of them already, you know, do the flow for you.
It changes the experience.
And that's
really
different than just reading a PDF. I mean, just reading a PDF to me is brutal.
Right. Right, and then, you know, zooming in and all that other stuff. I will always love opening a book. I will always love the feel of a comic. I will always love that experience. I don't begrudge what I view as inevitable technologies. And it's kind of funny, when people talk about technology, it's like it has to be better.
Right.
It doesn't mean it's better, it's just inevitable.
You know, absolutely. So. I do love the, you know, the notion that, you know, I don't know what I'm going to be in the mood for, so I'm just going to, I have, you know, a dozen different books at my fingertips that I can throw in a bag and not actually, you know, say, well, this is the book I packed, so this is what I'm stuck reading for the week. That's, you know, that's definitely something for anybody who has, you know, long commutes or anything like that.
Well, it makes my vacations easier, certainly. Like, I can bring more shoes if I'm not packing more books.
Yeah, there's that. There's that also. And I like the instant download sort of thing. Like, I, you know, I place an Amazon order and I have to wait a week to get something.
Oh, that is cool.
Versus just saying, oh, look, I got a book and download.
There are pros and cons, and you don't have to embrace everything. It's easy sometimes. I do feel bowled over sometimes by the technology until I remember that people can be very innovative with it, and we might not be seeing everything that digital is going to bring to us, but it's certainly exciting to see what people are doing new with it.
Yeah, it is definitely, you know, more interactive, I think, media approaches are going to be done. And, you know, but when I hear the word interactive, I sort of cringe, because already now when I go to websites and there's, you know, an auto-playing, you know, video on the side that feels the need that it has to play and the sound has to be on, and then a pop-up ad, and, you know, that won't even pop up right away. Like, I'll be, you know, two paragraphs into an article and then a pop-up ad hit.
Right.
Because it's like, oh, obviously you're staying here, so we're going to just throw this in your face.
I think these companies are learning, though, what's going to annoy their readers. Like, in the beginning of some of this, you know, digital advertising, like, the rollover sounded like this great idea, and then everybody's just like, what the hell is that?
Oh, yeah.
But people listen, and the bigger companies have the money and the time to kind of throw spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks. Independent publishers, you know, we don't have those kind of resources. We just have so much time and money to invest in this stuff. And we don't want to annoy anybody. And so
I'm like that with the technology devices themselves. Like, I didn't rush out to get an iPad. I didn't rush out to get a Kindle. I waited and waited and waited and waited, and when there were reviews coming in, I made the determination to say, okay, well, when it comes to, you know, where the dollars are best spent, that's why we ended up going with the Kindle Fire, which, you know, I realize is not as spectacular as an iPad, but an iPad is $500, so, you know,
You do walk that fine line between, like, the sexy new toys and then the stuff that's just going to end up collecting dust. So I'm, like, very much like you. I try to be very prudent in my purchases, and the next best thing, I don't have the money to throw at that stuff. But it's still, so much has evolved. So much of this stuff has evolved over time, too, and it's changing my life. I mean, it took me a while to get a smartphone, but now it helps me conduct my business, you know. And it's
absolutely. And I'm very irate, speaking of smartphones. I don't know if you're on Verizon, but I'm on Verizon and saw the news that they are doing away with unlimited data plans and doing away with their new every 2-year contracts.
Right.
So I'm like, okay, so now all of us are going to be going over our data plans, and all of us are going to have to pay full price for these ridiculous phones that are, you know, like this, you know, this, when I, because I got the insurance on my phone, and they're like, well, it's valued at $700. I'm like, for this? I'm like, it's freaking 4 inches, and it's valued at $700?
No. And I feel your pain. I do.
Yeah, so when I saw that news this week, there were many expletives about Verizon coming from my mouth.
Understood.
So let's go over some convention schedules for you while we have a couple minutes, so that, well, for you and for if you know of any group representation anywhere, then we'll cover that as best we can.
Okay. Going to be at Dragon Con in Atlanta, Georgia, coming up at the end of the month. Very quickly after that, we're going to be at Baltimore Comic Con. Yay!
Yay!
I had to miss it last year. A couple of the artists from Poe got to be there, but we didn't have the books yet. That was a huge bummer. But they got to go, and I missed that show. I love that show. So going to be there. Got, of course, New York Comic Con is coming up. I believe just before New York, Mid Ohio Comic Con is coming up. My goodness, And then North Carolina Con in later November. And I think that will finish up our year.
Yeah, I was going to say, you don't usually get much past, like, Halloween. It's rare. So.
Right. More shows we're updating as time goes on redstylo.com. You'll see the events calendar and more stuff getting added all the time. Also on our Facebook page. But what's also exciting is almost every one of the artists and writers working on the Shakespeare Shaken project, they're doing shows as well. And we're definitely getting the word out about where those folks are going to be too. So
right.
It looks like Red Stylo Media is everywhere.
It does.
We are. As a matter of fact, we are. So that'll be fun too. So updating, everything's to be announced as it happens, and sometimes pretty quickly. But if fans want us, they can, of course, demand that we show up somewhere, and then we will, as ever, try to get in.
That would be great. Yeah. Did you have anything last minute that you needed to add for the fans, for the potential fans that have never seen?
The first three stories are going to be released tomorrow online at redstylo.com and drivethroughcomics.com and amusedem.com and on Graphically.
Okay.
We are, the first three stories, the first is War of Theaters by Bobby Harps and David Fernandez. The second is Love Bug by John Santana and Ashley Lonnie. And the third, oh my God. I'm
in
so much trouble that I forgot.
Yeah, I think I have it open. We have Love Bug, Wharf Studios, and Star Cross.
Star Cross. I'm so sorry. James McGee, I do love you, I swear.
It's hard to remember this schedule. There's so much on it.
Yes. And Mark Mullaney. Actually, Mark Mullaney is another of our assistant editors, and I just forgot his name, but I just remembered him and his art. Star-crossed. These three stories will be released digitally for $1.99 each as individual downloads. And then we've got a couple of teaser pages from a comic called Brave World by A.I. Miller. He's a comics artist out of Charlottesville, Virginia. So lots of fun people. And really, really great projects. And that's the first wave. And then the following Wednesday, we've got some more titles as well.
So it looks like every Wednesday people will have content, which is very exciting. I see the name Jeremy Whitley pop out at me for...
Eisner nominee.
And I know Kristen and I will be very excited on Wednesday, August 29th, when our story comes out.
That's right. Number 130 for love. Wonderful story. Don't miss that one.
Thank you. So there will be so much on Twitter that day because, you know, I've sort of made peace with the fact that the way people just spam with their Kickstarter links and stuff, I'm like, all right, guys, it's payback.
That's another conversation, isn't it?
I'm like, that's just payback. Like, you people overdo it with, you know, take a damn break. Once in the morning, once at night, really, you're good.
Oh, no. You know, Red Stylo Media got its start on Kickstarter. We, like, as Tekka won its campaign. So I will forever be thankful to Kickstarter.
I think it's fabulous, and I want to do it. I'm very looking forward to my shot at it. But
yeah.
I think some people, literally 8 times an hour, too much.
I think it's the new thing that we have to get used to. It's more of a karma thing, too, because, you know, we'll probably come back to Kickstarter. Actually, we're planning to come back to Kickstarter for a very specific project later this year that will be announced soon. So I don't want to... I do understand that frustration about, too much, but
yeah.
At the same time, get it. Nobody else is going to beat your drum but you. You know, nobody
right.
else is going to get it out there. Nobody's going to care as much as you do. So God love all of you. And
yeah.
myself. Getting the word out there. So
Yeah. But definitely, you know, if you're ever running a Kickstarter, have some restraint so that you don't annoy the crap out of people. Otherwise, you're just going to get blocked, and that's not what you want. That's the opposite of what you want.
No, this is true. There's a finesse to walking that line.
You know, and Jimmy Palmiotti had the best advice. He's like, you know, wrangle a couple of your friends to post the links for you so that it's not always coming from your account that people are just going to say, oh, not again, and block you. There's definitely a better tact approach.
you're definitely plugged in. I try to be plugged in to all of the people in comics in the industry. So we're seeing a lot of industry stuff because we're so plugged in.
Right.
You're also hoping to sort of get out there, that ripple effect, and that's what comes with crowdfunding. So, yeah, it's a tug of war about what's between annoying and enough.
Yeah.
And if you're busy and all this other stuff, sometimes it's hard to do it enough. And a lot of projects fail because people don't promote this.
How do you walk that line? They're too afraid to pimp themselves out.
Right.
But so August 29th is my day, so that'll be...
Yes, every week. We're releasing 3 stories every week for the next month and a half. So there's going to be something new each day.
Okay, so then what happens when somebody orders the book? When will they actually get it?
The delivery date, we're looking at August 30th for delivery date. You can pre-order the book at redstylo.com and all that other good stuff. But, looking at August 30th for delivery.
Okay, so wait, September 30th or August 30th?
August 30th.
Okay.
As a publisher, you're always thinking like a couple of months ahead. Right now we're, in December I'm going to be planning Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Right now I'm thinking about Halloween, so everything's out for everybody that ordered the book and then just in time for Halloween.
Okay. Well, that's great. So folks, get out there, and when you get your copies, let's see some Shakespeare cosplay. Let's get that going. Let's make it a thing.
Ooh. All right, I'm going to let you start that one.
All right, Rika, thanks for your time, because I know you're super busy.
I'm excited. Thank you.
And don't forget, everyone, to check out redstylo.com. That's the link that you need to get completely plugged into the Shakespeare Shaken project. And to find out about all of the other projects as well. And I believe, what's your Twitter handle, Rika?
@red_stylo.
Okay. And I'm @ElizabethAmber on Twitter. Okay. So don't forget that you can find out more in the show notes and everything else at amberunmasked.com. And this episode was sponsored by Audible, so you can get a free trial of audiobooks and go learn about Shakespeare from there. Just go to audibletrial.com/amberunmasked. And thanks for joining me again, and thanks for listening.